Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today I'm joined by James Dalma, a machine learning expert. He's been on my channel many times over the past maybe 14 21. Months or so.
Yeah.
Exactly. We've developed a playlist called James Dalma on AI. I'm really going over the fundamentals of Tesla's full self-driving program. It's a fantastic playlist. I think it's probably bar none the best resource on Tesla full self-driving out there. Anyways, welcome James back on the show. How are you doing?
Great. I'm doing great. It's great to see you again.
It's been
months, hasn't it? For a while there, it seemed like I was seeing you every day, and now it's been 6 months.
Yeah, it's crazy. How has your 2021 been?
You know, it's been pandemic-tastic. We work from home, and I have for years, but the pandemic just took it to a new level of kind of feeling isolated from people. And so, like, I love doing there are aspects of the of it which are great, because I really like interacting over video and stuff, and not wasting time going places and whatnot. But it kind of accumulates after a while. You know, you have this sense of like cabin fever or whatnot that gets on. So there's that. But
sure.
It's been a good excuse to do stuff around the house and really drill down on a lot of projects I wanted to work on and stuff. So it's been good.
Awesome. So what I want to do with you in this video is I want to kind of do a preview of 2022 Tesla full self-driving, what to expect, kind of give a sense of where it could head. What are some of the challenges, you know, expectations with timeline? But before that, we had a big update with Elon Musk on Lex Fridman's podcast. And Lex was able to answer or ask a bunch of questions, because obviously he's interested in this and been following this. And Elon went into a bunch of kind of tidbits and updates. I wanted to tackle a few of them with you to kind of get a layman's explanation, or, you know, explanation for the layman of some of these technicalities. So the first update was Elon shared that version 11 will be the one stack to rule them all. And he's saying that there'll be a fundamental neural net architectural changes, replacing the C++ code with a lot of neural nets. So can you kind of explain, like, what's significant about this, the one stack and, you know, just these architectural changes?
One stack to rule them all. So they built a neural network and they train it for a particular environment. And I think they figured out sometime last year that, you know, they couldn't get a neural network to work well in a parking lot and also work well in a city street, just for example. So they had one that was working pretty well in parking lots and a different one on city streets and maybe a different one on highways or whatnot. And they weren't getting good. If they tried to train a single network to like do all of these things, they didn't get as good performance in each category as they were getting when they tried to put it all in one thing. So they had multiple stacks, where you'd basically switch out the neural network stack depending, the one you were using to drive would change depending on the circumstance. So you might have one on surface streets, a different one in parking lots, and so on. And then you have to change between them. Now, you get better performance if you're on surface streets and you just stay on surface streets and you're not stopped at a light or whatnot, you get good performance. But then you hit these boundary conditions where you have to change stacks, and there's all these little weird problems that occur there. So you really want one stack, but they want to go to one stack at a point when they're not going to see a big regression where like everything, you know, gets significantly worse than it was before. And I think that has not gone as quickly as they wanted it, because they were talking about it like 6 months ago, trying to unify the stacks, and then it kept getting pushed out and pushed out. And now we're hearing that they want to go to full surround video, and they have another, you know, major block they want to stick on the end of it. And, you know, is this when we get full stack? I hope so. You know,
So actually, I want to ask you. Yeah, I want to ask you about the full the surround video. So, you know, what's going on here? So they're saying that they want to kind of make almost everything, you know, full surround video. Like, what is that, and why is that important?
It gets them. So surround video is. Right now, there's eight cameras, and they all have these different fields of view, and they kind of overlap. And once upon a time, the way that they were driving, Elon talked about this some in the Lex Fridman video, you know, they had all the different cameras, and each camera saw some stuff. And then they had some C code that would take what all the individual cameras were telling them that it would that they were seeing, and they would try to synthesize that into an understanding of the environment, and then use that understanding to make decisions about how you were going to drive. Surround video does this trick where it takes, instead of having all of these different things in the neural network, they convert that into a single kind of omnidirectional view of what's going on. So you don't have different views from different cameras that you have to piece together. So that's the surround video part of it. In practice,
So is the surround video, is that different than this kind of vector space, this more 3D space with the objects and position?
Surround video is the input. It's kind of the input. So the way the network gets built, they're the kind of these stages. It starts with individual cameras. They have a bunch of neural networks that run the individual cameras. And these are legacy because when the system started out, it was just individual neural networks on individual cameras. Each camera would, the neural network would say what it was seeing that was relevant. And then the C code would basically combine all that stuff together into an understanding of the world. Later, in addition to those, they added to the different cameras an output that was designed to feed into another neural network that would synthesize all those into like a single view. But it was still from the car's view looking out at the world. Mm-hmm. Now they have another layer that sits after that. That's the bird's eye view, which is where you ask the neural network, if I was looking down on myself from above, what would the scene look like? Mm-hmm. And there's various reasons why that is really useful. But so you have kind of this intermediate product, which is the surround video thing. There's what comes from the cameras. Then there's a unification of the cameras. Then in the way that they build the network, you actually unify that across time. Like you take multiple of those things over time. So it becomes surround video, not surround single frames. Because the individual camera networks, they're just single frames. They don't look at video. Each individual frame gets an evaluation. The surround video, it combines all those together, and then it looks at how they evolve over time. So it's a single image that evolves over time. So it's not surround images, it's surround video now. And then from the surround video layer, that's when they try to flip it and say, okay, now tell me what it looks like from the top down, because that's a useful kind of way for the car to understand the environment. Okay, so we have these different stages. So there are networks that are still just doing the single frame thing. They're not doing the surround video frame thing.
Got it. Okay. Right?
So, they're just left over.
Okay, so you have, you take it from the cameras, and then you have these images that are stitched together to give this all around surround images, but then you need to make a surround video kind of out of that. And then you, from there, you take it to the next level where you do more of a bird's eye view. Mm-hmm. In that, where does kind of like the, not just the object detection, but the actual like, hey, this is the position and the velocity, you know, of each object in the scene. Does that happen in the bird's eye view?
It happens in multiple levels now because this is, remember, they've got this legacy stuff. They have this stuff that was running in the cars a couple of years ago, which is just look at the individual cameras. Each camera says, I saw, the front, you got multiple cameras facing forward, right? And they might say, you know, I see a pedestrian at this location and I think it's doing this. So it would have a location in the frame view, like the XY of the frame of a pedestrian. It might make a guess about the distance of that pedestrian based on their size or based on correlation with another camera at the sea level. And it might say, I think they're moving this way or that way. I mean, there would be stages of the network that would do that. At the individual camera level, it would just be, there's a single frame, here's a pedestrian, and it's in this location. That was where it started. These other functions kind of get bolted on, layer stage by stage. You know, it went from just having the cameras to having the surround images, to having surround video when they added time, and then they added the bird's eye view after that. So this is like a succession of modules that got incrementally added to the overall thing. Now, there's a lot of legacy stuff. At any given point, you know, they're going along and they kind of accumulate these legacy functions that they leave in there because they're working right now, and they want the system to continue working for users in the field. So, you know, you might rewrite part of it to solve a problem, but you don't want to touch this other stuff because it's working fine right now. And you want, you know, the changes that you're making, you just want to do on these things over here. Mm-hmm. But at some point, too much kind of cruft accumulates in the system and you want to do a stop and you want to bring everything up to date and get rid of as much old stuff as you can. So they still have this, they still have some neural networks that are still making important decisions based on single frames from single cameras. Now, when they get rid of that, They'll be able to get rid of all the evaluations at the individual camera level, bring everything forward to the surround video level, and then do any evaluations you want to make, any perceptions that you're going to make a decision from, they come from that level. So that simplifies the system significantly. And you can think of it as essentially getting rid of older stuff or bringing that stuff up so that it's consistent in its structure from the bottom to the top with the new stuff that's important before you move on to add more stuff. Reducing complexity mm-hmm. is helpful. It also improves the efficiency of the system, right? You do less computation, there's less redundancy.
Okay, so let's say we take the cameras and we get them to surround video. Does that happen like just via like heuristics, or are we talking about our neural nets?
That's all neural
performing
networks.
That's neural nets happening. And then from the surround video to the bird's eye view,
that's neural networks.
Neural networks as well, huh?
Right.
Okay.
So there were times in the past where some of these things were done partially heuristically and partially with neural networks, or entirely heuristically. Mm-hmm. And the evolution of the thing over time is that more and more of it gradually becomes neural networks. And each time they do that, they might add more heuristic stuff on the back end when they add new features. And then the neural network expands to absorb those features eventually too. So one of the things Elon said is in V11, they're going to get rid of the bag of points and have the neural network make vectors. So right now, the output of the BEV layer, the bird's eye view layer, is kind of this volumetric evaluation of the space around the car as, these points belong to a pedestrian or some pedestrians, and these belong to like a sign, and these belong to a fire hydrant, or these belong to another car. And then they have some C code that basically gets that collection of points, and it looks at a bunch of points together and say, oh, these points are all one car. So it has to take that bunch of points and turn that into a concept of a single car with a location and space and a velocity and all that kind of stuff. So now, instead of having C code do that, they're going to add another neural network layer that will take all those points, and the output of that will be, it won't be, point, 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 where some of those points are car and other ones are an adjacent pedestrian and some of them are a lane line. It'll be car, lane line, pedestrian, and so forth. So the neural network will be doing those evaluations. And so when they get it tuned up and working, it'll be more accurate. It'll be better at disambiguating, especially similar objects, which are, if you have two pedestrians right next to each other, you could imagine you have two pedestrians in a crosswalk holding hands. They're walking right next to each other. It can be hard for C code because pedestrians, their shapes move. Imagine they're wearing coats and it's blowing. Mm-hmm. One of them is, maybe one's a child or something. Like knowing that that's two people, writing C code to evaluate the points to do that is tricky.
Yeah.
And you want the consistency over time because you're using how it changes over time to make decisions about velocity and intent and that kind of stuff. It's better if the neural network does that.
Yeah. So, I mean, actually, that's interesting because I noticed like sometimes pedestrians on full self-driving beta, like on the side of the road, they'll be like in and out changing two to three pedestrians. Yeah. Would you say that would get significantly better?
Yeah.
When they do this rewrite, because you're not just taking, so what I'm understanding you saying is like, the reason for that discrepancy is they're taking these bag of points, but they're mixed. They're not just the pedestrian, pixels. They're a bunch of stuff. And then each frame is different. So it's like C code is, deciphering things, but it's going to change moment to moment. But if neural nets are doing this, they could just isolate, hey, this is the person, in this frame and just follow the person.
Well, imagine that I gave you, I took space and I broke it into like a 3D grid. And I labeled points as either being part of a pedestrian or not. And you get a blob and you get this weird shaped blob of points and it's all labeled pedestrian. And you got to look at it and you got to say, is it two pedestrians or one? Right. Or is it three? Right. Just by looking at the shape. And it's kind of coarse. It's not super fine grained. So writing C code to decide, is that one pedestrian or two, is tricky. Especially because pedestrians, they wear clothes and clothes blow in the wind and they carry shopping bags and, their shape changes and they vary a lot. And so whereas neural networks are much better at doing those kinds of decisions, making those soft decisions like this is three pedestrians because I see three heads or I see six legs or something like that. But if you write the code to do that, it's harder.
Mm-hmm. Got it. That's fascinating. Like when Elon was talking about bag of points, I was like, what is that? But I think your explanation definitely makes sense. That's exciting because if it gets more accurate, especially identifying objects, that seems like it ultimately will lead to, you know, better performance of the entire system.
Yeah, and it'll be really helpful for persistence of awareness of objects mm-hmm. that, you know, things that get occluded, you want to remember that they're there. That can be pretty important. It can be really important at times. Like the example of kids running between cars and stuff. Like you see the kid coming and then he disappears behind the car. You want to remember that he's coming out. You might want to remember that it's two kids, right? Yeah. Did you see two kids going behind the car and you only saw one come out? You might want to remember there's this another kid yet to come out, or that there might be. That's hard to see. And neural networks are better.
When Elon Musk talks about vector space, is he talking about kind of the bird's eye view? Or is like, what is he referring to? I mean, it feels like it's a 3D space, right? In the whole scene, right? And where every object is that what you equate to the bird's eye view? Or
no? Bird's eye view is an interesting thing. It's literally a top down view. Like if I was directly above the scene, looking down from a great height, what would I see? So that's a really useful representation, because cars mostly maneuver in two dimensions. You know, they stay on the ground. There might be hills and stuff like that, but you can think of it as a 2D surface that they move around on. And most of the things we care about, whether it's, you know, curbs or lane markings or pedestrians, they're also restricted to the ground. Occasionally you get stuff with bridges. I mean, there's a extra dimension occasionally you have to worry about, but a lot of the problem of driving can be thought of as a 2D problem. But of course, if the 2D is looking out the windshield, you know, distances and objects interacting and occluding can be kind of complicated. Like looking down from the top, you know, two pedestrians are always two pedestrians side by side. It's really rare for one pedestrian to be on top of another and appear from a bird's eye view to be one. But if you're looking at pedestrians across the street, sometimes two pedestrians occlude each other. If you're looking at a crowd, it can be really hard to tell how many there are. If you look from the top down, it's much more clear. So that's a nice perspective just from a driving standpoint, but it does another interesting thing. One, which is neural networks, when you train these things from scratch, they don't know the world is three-dimensional, right? You're giving them a bunch of camera views and they don't know starting out, are these camera views into a two-dimensional world, a three-dimensional world, a four-dimensional world? We want them to know it's three dimensions. But it turns out it's actually tricky. You can't force them to know that. You have to ask them questions that cause them to realize that it's three dimensions. And a very useful trick for doing that is you ask them, what would it look like from this angle? Because in order to be good at answering, like what does the world look like if I was looking at it from straight down, they have to get that it's three dimensional, right? So not only do you get a useful representation for planning and for driving and, you know, in the real world, but you also get to force the neural network to do that dimensional extension to understand that the world is 3D. So that's another good reason to do the BEV. But at the end of the day, the BEV, it's that Cartesian bag of points output, right? Mm-hmm. What you'd really like the neural network to tell you at some point is that's a car, and here's its position, and here's its orientation, and here's its velocity. And the reason you want it to tell you that is because the guy somewhere down the road, there's a human being still writing policy code, most of the planning code. And they want to be able to write a line of code that says, if there's a car in front of me, slow down. Or if this car is crossing my path, you know, extrapolate the vectors forward in time. And if we're going to conflict, slow down or speed up or do something, right? That's a lot easier than here's a blob of points. Is it one car, two cars? Is it a bicyclist? You know, and then make decisions based on that.
Got it.
So the more of the pattern recognition that the neural network does and the less of it that the programmers and the people writing the policy code and the planning code have to deal with, the better the system's going to work. It's going to be cleaner. It's going to run smoother. It's easier to tune the accuracy of pattern recognition when it's in a neural network.
Got it. So we go from cameras to surround video, and then I'm guessing we go to
vectors. And then you get the bird's eye view, which is the point.
And then
now they're going to add a layer that gives vector space.
Got it. Okay, interesting. So the goal ultimately though is accurate vector space.
I'd say it's accurate perception, right?
Okay.
So vector space is a way of presenting the things, but there are higher level things, and they will add other things down the road. I mean, bird's eye view was a huge leap forward when they added that to the stack. Like, it really improved the, you challenge the network to understand things about the world that it didn't have to before. And once it started understanding those things, that made everything else make more sense to the network. So it could make, it had a better understanding of what was going on around it. And the asking for, you know, but once again, the bird's eye view, it produces this big bag of points. And the big bag of points in the top down view or in the volumetric view is way better than multiple big bags of points that you're getting from different views, where the C code also has to figure out how all those correlate. Now the C code doesn't have to do that. It's just got one big bag of points, but they're still points. And then it's easier if they're objects. And, you know, down the road, it would be great if you could just say, don't hit anything. You know, you could have very simple instructions that would go forward. You don't have to make lots of small, fine-grained decisions that you have to tune. And what the progress of the neural networks is, it's going to provide more accurate, more generalized, more simple things for the downstream code to make decisions based on.
Mm, yeah. I mean, it sounds like what's happening is on a higher level view, Tesla is doing what is obviously the next step, which is to make things more accurate, but including having the neural nets having more of playing a bigger role, getting more of everything surround video, everything into, you know, vector space, having the neural nets do it. So it's more efficient. It's ultimately more accurate. So, I mean, it looks like it's all, you know, pretty exciting stuff, you know? I mean, it's what you should expect Tesla to be doing if they're, you know, really pushing this.
It's great forward to hear this stuff because they're not stalling out, right? They continue to have good ideas for how to move to the next level and the next level and the next level and the next level, because we're not done, right? There's a lot of ground yet to cover. Mm-hmm.
Do you, when you listen to Elon Musk on like Lex Fridman, kind of just off the cuff, talk about, you know, what full self-driving beta needs, version 11. Like, my kind of impression is like, wow, this is like a CEO who isn't, he's doing a lot of other things too, like with SpaceX and his other companies and managing, you know, he's like, you know, CEO, yet he's pretty familiar with everything that's going on, the major issues and how they're trying to solve
them. When he goes to technical meetings, right?
Yeah, it's like, wow, that's quite impressive. Yeah.
No, it's, I can't, you know, what other CEO? Like, I can't think of another CEO that ever pulled out. I mean, Steve Jobs knew a lot about his products, but this level of technical detail? Yeah. No, not even close.
Yeah. It's like, it's amazing. There's something about it where it's also another bullish thing when you have Elon Musk, the CEO, he's not distant from it. He's like really involved. I think he was quoted, I forget which interview, was saying like Starship and full self-driving is like the two things that give him the most, I wouldn't say headache, but take the most attention, you know, his mind. And it makes sense because they're hugely, you know, big problems to solve. They haven't been fully solved yet. But I think the Lex Fridman interview kind of showed, you know, he's really into it. You know, this is something he's committed to.
I think the role is probably a bit different, right? It's not difficult for me to believe that Elon has deep technical opinions about, you know, whether Starship should be carbon fiber or stainless steel. Like, he himself will originate like theory. And I think that he's in the machine learning end of the full self-driving and the AI part, I imagine that he's much more about telling people to be fearless and getting them to continue moving forward and expressing confidence and taking responsibility for the decisions and that kind of stuff. And much less about, the problem right here is like, we need to change the input distribution of the training set over to this kind of thing. You know, I think he understands the topic really well, but machine learning is super specialized and a lot, you know, it's got all these little subdivisions of people that are going to be very specialized. And it's not that that's not true of rockets. But my general sense of the thing is he has a much more holistic understanding, like a deep understanding in all of the specific things that like go into the metallurgy of the Raptor engine, say.
Sure.
And much less, you know, why did we use this? Why did we use this loss function for this part of the network as opposed to the other thing? I think he's probably unlikely to have strong opinions about the nature of loss functions used for subsets of the network.
Right? Sure, definitely. Okay, so one of Elon's comments on the Friedman podcast was they want to go from like raw photons, skip the image processing.
Yeah.
How significant is that?
How significant is it? It's a sign of maturity. That's my kind of biggest takeaway on the thing. So,
I mean, is the ultimate goal just to improve latency?
That's probably a big part of it. I wouldn't be surprised if the original impetus was, hey, you know, this ISP is costing us 15 whole milliseconds, and the only way to get it out of there is to get rid of it, you know? And so let's have the neural network take over that kind of stuff. But another thing that's also true is, you know, the cameras have a natural color space and they have a natural kind of dynamic range and degree of linearity that the sensor has and that kind of stuff. And when you post-process that, I mean, cameras in the real world, they mostly get post-processed to make images that make sense to human beings. So they render in a color space and a dynamic range and whatnot that a human being looking at a screen or a video or something, it makes sense to them. It's got good clarity and the human eye can capture details and that kind of stuff. But the camera's fundamental trade-offs of strengths and weaknesses are very different when you interpret them like as a human versus if you just take them for their actual physical characteristics. So freeing up the neural network to not have to dumb itself down to the way a human sees it. And that, when I say dumb itself down, there are certain things about human perception that are challenging to duplicate. And there are other things that humans can't perceive. They're actually really easy for a neural network to see, right? Because they, you know, the human perceptual system has certain constraints, which are a function of, you know, how humans have to live their lives. Neural networks don't necessarily have that. So there's this different set of strengths and weaknesses that you can expose by not trying to filter what the neural network sees through the constraints of what a human wants to see, right? And so going to raw photons is kind of a way to get to that. Is, you know, what's the rawest, simplest thing I can get? Like, what's the truest representation of all the things the camera can tell me about what it's seeing? And so don't hide any of it. Don't translate any of it. Don't dumb any of it down. Don't trim any of it away. Just give me the whole thing. So the neural network develops a perception system which is suited to the cameras. Mm-hmm. It's not an approximation. So when I say maturity, there's a lot you can accomplish just using the images that a human can easily interpret. And one of the nice things about trying to do it that way is that human beings can look at those images and they can say, oh, it's not seeing the shadow, or, oh, it's mistaking this tree for this sign behind it. Or, I mean, it's easier to interpret. But at some point that becomes a limitation. Eventually you get to a point where of the remaining low-hanging fruit that you can go after to get better performance, a significant amount of it is in stuff that the people looking at the stuff can't see, but that the camera can see really well. So human perception, we have very limited grayscale dynamic range that we can see. Like, humans can only see like 32 scales of gray, 32 shades of gray in a single frame. It's very, very limited. But a camera can see like thousands, right? Cameras intrinsically have extremely high dynamic range. So if we let the neural network have the full access to the entire dynamic range, it's going to be able to see nuance in dark video that a human being just cannot see. Our eyes just don't provide that amount of discrimination in low light. So when Elon was talking about, oh yeah, they're, you know, the cameras are incredible in low light. Yeah, to a human being, you'd be looking at the screen. It looks dark and you see like 3 or 4 points. And you're like, yeah, that's a car and a pedestrian next to it. A human would have no idea, but the neural network can look at that and say, yeah, camera pedestrian or a car pedestrian, and it'll get it. And that, so when, once they've got to the point where they're taking the ISP out, not only do they save the milliseconds, but we can also say the effort itself is getting to a level of maturity that difference is starting to matter to them.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just the 15, let's say, milliseconds of latency solved or saved, but would you also say eventually it becomes more accurate over time?
Oh, yeah.
Raw photons? Okay.
So it's always a little tough to talk about it. Every time they add a new brick to the stack or they add a new function to the thing, the first thing that happens is everything's going to go to hell, right? Because you fine-tuned all this downstream stuff to exactly what your input was. Now we change the input. So, you know, the basic structure still works fine, but now all the tuning is all screwed up, right? So you got to go back and go through the effort of tuning everything. And there will be some trade-offs that you didn't have before. So, you know, but if you made a good guess, if your intuition is right and you build your networks the right way and that kind of stuff, at the end of that process, you know, it's that, you know, you have a regression and then you get a recovery. And then if you're right, you recover to a much higher level than you were stuck at before.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So a side tangent, I'm curious, like, do you have any like rough guesstimate of how many people might be involved in Tesla's like AI, you know, machine learning FSD efforts? Because I was surprised where at Tesla AI Day, I think it was there, where they were saying they have like over 1,000 labelers in-house. Was even outsourced. And I was like, wow, that's like a big ramp. Because, you know, I mean, in the early days of Autopilot, I felt like it's just like a few dozen, you know, like engineers or something in the early days. But I don't know. It's like, it seems like it's branched off to many, many teams, right? You have, you know, probably a hardware team. You have the whole, you know, neural
apparently
nets.
They have a C compiler development team.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't expect that.
They have the chip team, training, you know, all sorts of tooling teams. Like, it just seems like it feels like it's a huge company within a company in a sense, right? I mean,
it'd be easier to guess if it wasn't Tesla, right?
Yeah.
Because they seem to run with very, very low headcount and in these kinds of functions. So, you know, I mean, a conventional company, it'd be, you know, many thousands of people, you know, if GM fleshes out, you know, a conventional, conventional style development effort, and they try to do something like this, you know, the Autopilot software team is going to be 5,000 people or something like that. And I think Tesla probably doesn't have, and I'm not counting labelers. I'm talking about the people who contribute to the code that goes in. To the thing, which might include the compiler developer and that kind of stuff, but it doesn't include the chip guys and it doesn't include Dojo or any of that stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd be interested just to know what the total like manpower behind everything is, you know?
I heard for a long time that the AI portion was like 30, the headcount was 30.
Yeah. Yeah. If there's any Tesla AI folks listening, shoot me a DM. back to the updates on Elon Musk. So he was talking about this C compiler and them doing, you know, this bare metal engineering. Can you kind of explain like what's like, it feels like, I mean, from my limited understanding, it's like they're really trying to squeeze like efficiency out, you know, to go into this level of, you know, effort. Can you unpack this? Like, what does this mean and how does this, you know, improve efficiency? Is it worth it, you think?
I was pretty surprised to hear that they were developing a C compiler. I would guess that the main reason they're doing that is because they have a mix of hardware, some of which they make and some of which they buy. And existing compilers weren't doing a good job of partitioning functions between those two things. And so they decided to augment that. Writing your own C compiler to like make an ARM core faster, it kind of doesn't make sense. Like it's so down in the, now there could be things where Tesla might say, we only need this subset of functions. Like he was talking, I think he described their C compiler as a subset of the C language, right? Which you could imagine that for a particular application, we have the C code, we need to run really fast. It only has this set of operands that I need to work with. And my priority for how fast they are or how they interact is this. And so I'm going to build a C compiler to do that. Although today you would almost certainly modify an open source compiler instead of write your own. Maybe they write one from scratch. But I think Elon did mention something along the lines of, you know, they have their own hardware, which is mixed in there. And that creates challenges for using regular, you know, off the shelf C compilers. And so they've built their own.
Mm-hmm. Got it. All right. So let's go into FSD timeline. So Lex Friedman asked, like, you know, when does Elon think level 4 FSD would be achieved? Elon said most likely by end of next year. What's your take? Do you think that's realistic? And also, like, what are we talking about? I mean, with level 4, it seems like we're talking about, you know, you can kind of comfortably go to sleep in the car, but the car will wake you up if it needs to.
So that's not what I heard.
Yeah. Okay.
So broadly speaking, I think he's becoming more specific, you know, less vague about his assertions and less, you know, over the top optimistic about how soon things are going to happen. What I heard was a fairly specific, narrow assertion that the intervention rate for serious interventions that on the current improvement curve, that in next year, that it looks like it will cross underneath the, you know, human accident rate. Right. So those are kind of two really gross ways of sort of trying to compare FSD to where it needs to be. If where FSD needs to be is a benchmark in terms of how humans drive, like once it's twice as good as people or four times or whatever, like if that's our benchmark for when we move to the next phase of like letting the car drive without or not requiring people to pay as close attention or turning it loose on a city as a robotaxi, like if that's your benchmark, you need some human metric and then you need some approximately equivalent FSD metric that you track over time. So you can sort of try to make a prediction about when they cross. And one way you could look at this, and this is what I'm hearing, but you know, I'm extrapolating a bit from what he's saying, is that they have this sort of synthetic metric, which is human accident rate, right? Like, and once they get the interventions, you know, that if the interventions that you have to do to avoid an accident when you're driving FSD, if that number comes down and down and down, eventually it crosses below. Now, of course, if a human is the person doing the intervention, FSD, as seen by humans, it can't cross under that threshold, right? Because at some point the human starts causing accidents for FSD when they do interventions, right? And this is something that's been seen. You know, humans intervening with self-driving systems have caused some of the worst accidents that the self-driving systems have had. So that's a real thing. So when those two numbers start to cross, you have to make a decision at the program level to let the car override the human instead of letting the human override the car. Like when that becomes the only way for the system to get safer, now you're taking the human out of the loop because that's safer. You're crossing that threshold. So I think they've got this approximate metric that they think that they need to get to, and they're tracking the internal metric of FSD, which Elon used the term interventions. Other people have talked about it. I'm not sure if interventions is actually the best number, but he used it. So maybe that's what they're using. Maybe that is the best, but they're watching the intervention rate go down and down and down as they iterate the thing. And so you can imagine you plot those over time and then you look forward and you say, well, if we keep on this slope, you know, this is when we get to this benchmark point. And I think, you know, it sounded like Elon was saying, yeah, you know, when we draw that line right now, like in the fourth quarter of next year, or the third quarter of next year, they look like they'll cross. But, you know, your progress line is like this. So drawing a line, making a prediction is a little, you know, it's not a simple thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like when Elon responds to these timeline things, I think I feel like they're two different kind of angles. One angle is the capability of the system, meaning FSD, how just good will it be? Not in terms of will regulators accept it? Can you really sleep on the car, whatever? Mm-hmm. It's not that, it's just, will it be like as good as a human, just in its kind of ability, but still you know, you're going to still probably going to be watching it, or, you know, there's going to be oversight. And I feel like that type of benchmark where in your, say, whether they use interventions or accidents, et cetera, it seems like he's seeing it's going to come, you know, hopefully by the end of next year. But the actual implementation of people sleeping in their cars, you know, or, you know, closing their eyes for 5 minutes at a time, I don't think that's going to obviously happen next year. I mean, what's your take?
I think there were times in the AP program when it really seemed like it was stuck. Mm-hmm. And then like 2 months later, it was so much better. Like, you know, because they had a fundamental improvement on something really core. And all of a sudden it was just like really dramatically better. So, you know, I drew the line when, you know, the actual progress looks like this, right? And then you draw a line through it and you make a prediction. But, you know, it could be that the thing that puts them over the line puts them 4x over the line, you know, 2 months after they cross the line, not 10% over the line. Yeah. But those things do happen, right? That's not what I'm betting on.
Sure.
And that's not what I would predict. I think that the safe thing to do is to predict just the, you know, it's the same thing with stock prices. They go bzzz, and you draw a line through it and you make your predictions based on that line, right? Mm. Understanding that there's a lot of noise. And, you know, like when the stock price crosses through 1,000, it might go to 1,200 or it might go to 1,001 and turn back around. Right. You know, it's like that. So, you know, if where they have to get is 1,000, you know, in their improvement score or whatnot, it could be that, you know, that they're at 2,000 2 months after they cross through 1,000. And so from the external perspective, it could look like they go relatively quickly from, you know, being good enough to feel comfortable with letting the machine override the human, right? To, yeah, we really better do that, right? Because, you know, it's just not safe to let the people override the machine anymore, right? Like that could, because, you know, a factor of two in accident rates, like that has a real world consequence. If you wait until the machine is 10x, better than people before you let it make the decision, you've waited too long, right? There's, you know, if you wait, you know, if the machine crosses over being better than a human and it gets 2x better than a human and you wait 3 years until it's 10x better than a human, if it were to take that long, then that's 3 years of highway fatalities you could have avoided, right? So, and I think that's a really hard decision to make. And I think it's really hard to predict how regulators are going to. So I'm very sympathetic to Elon or people at Waymo or Cruise or anybody who is not sure about when they're going to get to do this because they're not confident. Like what's that crossing going to look like? What's the data going to say, and how are regulators going to respond to it when we get it? It could be really clear for 2 years that the cars are better than people before regulators are willing to let people do it. Or it could be that regulators are completely cold-blooded and they just look at the numbers and they're like, yeah, that's the right answer. Right.
Yeah.
And maybe it's jurisdictional, you know, maybe they make one decision in China and they make a different decision in France.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. When did you get full self-driving beta?
I got it the day that they rolled out 10.3. So I got to do the whole crazy phantom braking for one day and then get 10.31.
Was that, was that in like,
it was a few months ago,
September or October or something. Okay.
Yeah, I'd have to go look.
Okay. Yeah. I remember.
And then I didn't get an update until 10.8, which I just got.
Oh, really?
Well, sorry. I have three cars with FSD beta on them, actually.
Really?
But one of them, my dad has one of them in Iowa right now. And so I don't drive that one. My girlfriend has a three. My spouse has a three.
Yeah.
And so hers has mostly stayed up, but I mostly drive my S. And it didn't get anything until 10.8. So
interesting.
I've been driving that one a lot.
Yeah. So how's your experience been? I know for those who don't know, James and I, we were driving FSD beta together in my car. This is back in the summer, maybe August.
Yeah, we were on like, you drove 9.0 and then I think we drove together on 9.1.
Yeah. So we spent like a good 3 hours or so driving. Yeah. enough where you had your own profile, James. My car.
Oh,
and
then,
and my kids are like, why do we have James down with profile on our car? Yeah. So how has your experience been? Like, have you
Mine has been good.
Have you seen improvements? Like
I did see, okay. So I have to put context around this, right? Yeah. When I drove AP, I felt like I had a really good understanding of how it evolved because I was really driving a lot at the time and I drove everything on AP. And I drove similar routes over and over again. Like I have this route between Los Angeles and San Francisco, which I've driven so many times. And so when I was letting AP drive it, you know, I knew every single corner, you know, after I'd had it for a little while, where it was going to work and not going to work, every hill and rise and curve and every place where the line was off, you know, on the side of the road and the car was going to get confused. So I could watch all those things evolve. And after doing that for a couple of years, I felt like I had a really strong, visceral sense of how the progress worked. So I'm not there with FSD, right? I haven't been able to drive it as much. And it's a much more complicated bag of stuff. But so I'm not super confident about my perception that it's improving, but my perception is definitely that it's improving. And I've been very pleasantly surprised that the rate of improvement I have seen is more than I expected to see on FSD. Considering, you know, I got to ride in cars that had FSD 8 and you were gracious enough to give me some experience with 9. And I didn't see huge improvements there, right? And so I was kind of expecting 10 to, you know, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, to just kind of, you know, fiddle around. And if I looked back from like, you know, 10.8 back to 10.3 or 11 back to 10.3, that I would see definite improvement, but it wouldn't be like earth shattering or anything. But I feel like 10.8 is quite a lot better than 10.3 is. Now, is that sustainable? I hope so. We'll see, you know, after I have a year of experience with watching it go, I think I will feel pretty comfortable with making predictions about how the program will go, say a year forward. But right now it's harder to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But I would like that metric that Elon talked about on Lex's show, like for a long time now, I've felt like if I was inside the autopilot team and I was trying to make predictions about where the program was going, like that is the metric I would be using. I would be looking at interventions that actually avoided the negative consequence, right? Which is, that's a little different from every single intervention. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they get recordings of the interventions and they could try to sort those and say where, you know, how many serious interventions were there? Like if the driver didn't intervene, there really would have been consequences. And you can plot those over time. And that will be a really good metric. If they see steady, you know, percentage-wise improvement, you know, if they get 20% improvement every month, that's a 10x improvement over the span of a year. And that's qualitatively different.
Yeah. That's true. 10x is big. Do you think Tesla will need Dojo, the training power that it can carry to kind of bring it over this hump where, you know, they get these 10x improvements? Or do you think, you know, just with their existing training, just computers, they can just add on to them? And I guess another question is, do you think, because we had Tesla AI Day a while back, do you think we'll see Dojo, like I'm sure they're focused on it, but by the end of next year, will we start to see some of
will
its
we
fruit?
Ever see Dojo again?
Like, will it, you know, make an impact?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe the next time they have to recruit some people, maybe they'll trot it out again and we'll get to see it. It's so hard to know. I don't have any connections to Tesla.
Yeah.
So, you know, I see on Twitter, you probably know way more than I do about this stuff.
No.
At Tesla speed, I expect Dojo has made good progress since. And, you know, maybe they've got a cabinet running. Like, it wouldn't surprise me. You know, what we knew at AI Day was that they had a tile and it ran. They were running code on it. They'd been able to run Carpathy's mini GPT, which is like, that's significant, not because it's a good benchmark or anything like that, but it's a neural network of a certain level of complexity. And if you can run it and you can run all the constituent elements of it and you can get the results out of it that you get when you run the same thing on a different machine, you know you've achieved a certain level of completion of the project overall. If they've got a tile and they make a tile work, like, you know, it's a Lego, and building a, you know, we don't, to get multiple tiles to work, they have to get the intertile fabric functional. Mm-hmm. And that has a nice characteristic that you can just detune the fabric. Like if there's a reason that they can't get, that it's not running at the bandwidth that they want, it's almost certain to run at half that bandwidth, right? So you could imagine them like, the fabric's not working quite the way that we want it to, but we can still tile up a bunch of machines and we're just not getting the interconnect bandwidth that we want. We can build a rack. We can build two or three or four racks. So I think for that scale of like, system level completion, I think it's pretty likely that they've got stuff working now. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe they have to rev the silicon again to get to get all the stuff that they want, or maybe the first silicon worked great. They had said that their first cut of at the D1 core was working great. They didn't have any problems with it, and it executed the way that they wanted it to. If the fabric is working too, the packaging technology, like we saw, it was mature. Yeah, it could be. Yeah, like I would kind of expect that they would have racks of them this year, mm-hmm. or sort of by a year from AI Day. Mm-hmm. Like that's what I would expect. Yeah, that's a total guess on my part.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Awesome, man. Good catch up on lots of things with Tesla AI FSD. Anything else you think you might be expecting regarding Tesla AI in 2022? I mean, obviously we got full self-driving improvements. We got a possible Tesla bot prototype that Elon mentioned, right? End of the year. Do you think that might be a reality? I mean, are your expectations pretty basic in terms of what it could do? Any thoughts on that?
So we talked before, like bot AI for doing tasks in the real world is a lot more complicated than doing the car AI. I think the car AI is a fine foundation. Perception is like the whole deal, like getting really good perception. And there's a huge overlap between the perception the robot has to develop and the perception that you have to develop for the car. So a huge amount of what they learn on the car is directly applicable to doing the robot. The mechanics of the robot, I feel like Tesla's actually, this is something that we said, and maybe even on the very first call that we had, you asked me about the robot thing. Yeah, I was like, if anybody could do the robot, it would be Tesla. And it's, the stuff that that Elon said on Lex's podcast, Tesla's probably the best company in the world to make those motors. And the motors are key. Like the analysis that I had done a couple of years before we had that conversation was that the motors are like the biggest missing link. And then after that, the power electronics and the controllers and that kind of stuff. Like you get the motors, the power electronics, the controllers, motors that are designed for a robot. Right. Because adapting existing motors, the existing actuators, they all have these various limitations, which are, as far as I can tell, the physics allows you to do things that are actually really well suited to robots. But companies building actuators haven't built those actuators. And Tesla could. I think, Tesla has the right design philosophy to do it. But that's a completely novel product and it's a completely novel production methodology. And it'll take some time to get it well refined. It's super easy for me to believe that they would have a compelling and, prototype, at the end of this year. At some point you stop, making your gullwing doors work and you try to push a car out the door, right? And they'll have to do that with the robot too. Because the ultimate place that you want to go with the sensors and actuators and power control and all that kind of stuff, like that, they can't do in a year, even Tesla. Mm-hmm. It's just way too complicated a problem. It takes too much manufacturing and too much volume and too many, other things to do, but they could have an interesting prototype in a year. I think mm-hmm. it won't look like what the final robot looks like. Mm-hmm. The software itself, maybe they'll be able to have it do dances and that kind of stuff. They probably, they're not going to have something folding laundry and washing dishes
sure.
this year. Like that's really, really hard to do.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Any thoughts on possible X holding company combining all of Elon's companies into one?
All the stuff I've heard you talk about it is consistent with my own thinking. I think it seems functionally hard to do. Mm-hmm, yeah. You know, investors like things broken out. Like I'm an investor. Yeah. I like things broken out. You know, I like to decide how much I put into company A and company B. I can imagine kind of functional advantages to Elon gathering all this stuff under, I mean, mainly in terms of cross funding,
right?
Like that seems like, you know, there are going to be some of these efforts that are wildly profitable long before others, you know, while others are still starved for cash. And if you put them all under a single holding company, it's easier to, you know, feed cash to the cash starved units from the ones that are flush. And I think that, you know, in terms of making, say, Neuralink go, you know, that could be a big deal to them.
Yeah.
But I don't know enough about management to really understand the trade-offs.
Looking forward to 2022, apart from FSD and just Tesla in general, what are you watching out for? What are you looking for? What do you think is important? Are you looking, you know, just to see how the 4680 cells go, how the ramps for Austin and Berlin, or just any financial
things, all those
like margins? Like
those are super important. The battery ramp, I feel like, is the most important for like how Tesla is doing at the end of 23. I feel like how the battery ramp goes in 22 is the most important thing. And after that, I would say the ramp between Austin and Berlin are like number two. This is taking FSD off the table, right? Just talking about these other things. I think the battery ramp is pretty important. And here's the thing I've seen a couple of the videos that you've done recently talking about 2022, looking forward to it. Something that hasn't been mentioned is the reason that energy isn't expanding explosively is completely battery limitation. Like if the battery limitation comes off the table, energy can ramp so much faster than the cars ramp, right? So right now, you know, analysts, you know, energy is a rounding error on everybody's Tesla model, right? And Elon has said a bunch of times, oh, energy will be as big as cars. And I really believe that too. The profitability of energy is a much more direct trade-off between like, what does the demand look like and how many batteries can we make? And I am, you know, you look at the cost of solar and wind compared to other forms of energy. And I believe, plus all the other benefit that you get from batteries, like the time-wise load leveling and that kind of stuff, the instant response, the, you know, frequency services and all that kind of stuff. They're a really big deal. And I feel like worldwide demand for those is going to vastly outstrip Tesla's ability to make batteries for a long time. But that unlike cars, they will be able to ramp that just at a crazy, crazy rate. And they'll only be limited by batteries. So a thing that I think is interesting is a possibility that the energy business goes from, you know, a small fraction of the car business to like the car business size in like a year or two, if the batteries are there to do that. That would be a really, it would be discontinuous to what analysts are expecting. I mean, they're not expecting FSD and I am. So like, that's big, but I think they're not expecting energy either. And I think energy is going to take off really fast.
I mean,
when they solve the battery problem.
The problem though with energy is like if you get to the same amount of batteries that you use for cars, the revenue and the profits can be a lot lower because the cost is a lot lower. Because with a car, you're adding on all these extra, you know, parts, and you're charging a lot more, you know,
so
for the car.
Tesla's charging a lot more for cars than we thought that they were going to be charging for cars, right?
That's true,
They're charging more for cars than they thought they were. You listen to Zach and he's like, wow, you know, the world woke up and now they all want EVs. And they have to raise the prices really quite dramatically just to keep the lead time down below a year. That's like a thing that happens when demand gets way ahead of supply. And so, you know, if we have this totally, you know, functional mindset about energy, then you're like, oh, it's a 20% margin business or a 10% margin business. And that's all they're going to make on it. And the value add is just the batteries. And there's not much on top of that. But if demand is way out of sync with production capacity, which I think is a not unlikely situation for the first 5-10 years that they're making batteries, then batteries could turn out to actually be really I wouldn't be shocked if batteries turn out to be more profitable than cars, but than utility batteries. That they have a higher gross margin, and that's what in that sense it could totally happen.
Yeah, we'll see. I want to ask you about your psychology of the Tesla stock price. So over the past couple months, we saw Elon Musk selling, a bunch of Tesla shares. This was right after, Tesla hit 1200. Everyone mm-hmm. was elated. And then, this slow drip, right, of Elon selling a little bit at a time, the stock price going down, to 900 or whatever. Are you just kind of chill this whole time? Are you just like, I don't care, I'm not gonna look at it? Or are you kind of like, do you have some emotion, during this fluctuation?
I absolutely have no interest in, so my situation with this thing is, like, I went to as all in as makes sense years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm not selling any of it for 10 years. And between now and then, I don't care what the stock price is, right? Because, unless the stock goes to like $5,000 this year, I'm not even going to think about it, right? Hmm. And I don't care if it goes to $100. I'm not selling it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of space in there, and I don't really expect to see a lot of price action outside those boundaries for a while. And so until it gets out of there, I don't care. And all this is just noise.
Yeah. So what happens when you do look at the stock price? You just go, whatever.
I pay pretty close attention to day-to-day stuff. Is my experience with mm-hmm. this in other investments that I've made over time is that I want to stay connected to what's going on, because I want to have a sense of, I don't want, in principle, the way that I built this strategy is I can just walk away from it and not think about it for a couple of years and just wait for it to hit my price triggers. Like mm-hmm. I could do that. Mm-hmm. But once you get to a point where you need to make a decision because the situation has changed, you're not well equipped to make good decisions because you haven't been paying attention. So I want to keep paying attention because I want to continue to understand this company and its I'm super interested in the technology outside. Even if I didn't have an investment in the company, I would be really into all the stuff that they're doing. So I would probably be following it closely anyway. But I follow the stock stuff pretty closely because I don't want to become disconnected from it.
Got it.
So I spend way too much time hearing people complain that Elon isn't done selling stock, even though it doesn't matter. You think we're going to remember this in 5 years? Nobody's going to remember this in 5 years. It so doesn't matter.
Sure.
If you're trading, if you're selling covered calls or whatever, it super matters. And I totally get that, but that, I don't do that.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to do that. And so it just has zero effect on any decision I'm going to make in the short run. I was happy to see him do it. I've been in a situation where I had to liquidate, options in a company and do all the matches and that kind of stuff. And it's a pain in the butt and you want to get it over with. And I'm happy that he had said, and I think it's probably true, that he felt kind of obligated to leave money on the table because he wanted to do the right thing by his investors, right? Yeah. Be, the last person out to say to people investing in his company, our interests are totally aligned because I am fully invested in this company. Mm-hmm. And when at some point people are like, you're being a jerk because you're not selling it. It's good for him to take some money off the table and do other things with it. It's going to reduce his financial stress because he doesn't have to face imminent bankruptcy in the same way he's not going to be bankrupt, but
yeah.
Do billionaires go to zero? Is that even possible? I don't think it is, but I gotta believe it decreases his stress level significantly to be able to take something off the table. And I don't, as long as it doesn't change the mix of his control in the company, so it doesn't dilute his influence, then I don't think it matters.
Sure.
And
sure.
You could argue diluting his influence might be, people have argued that diluting Elon's influence would be good. I'm not a party to that.
Yeah.
way of thinking about things, but I think it is debatable.
Yeah, definitely. Sounds good. Hey, before we started chatting, you mentioned you got a new MacBook Pro. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, did you get a was it a spec'd out one or what's the spec? So it's the top of the line. That's
one of the advantages of having invested in Tesla a while back. Yeah, I don't have to compromise on my laptops.
So basically just fully loaded everything.
No, actually, I only got 2 terabytes of memory on it.
Oh, okay.
My experience is that I just don't use more than that. Yeah. The projects I want to import, I don't actually do the video rendering.
Yeah.
It's really made for content creators, right?
Yeah.
They're the people who are going to make the most use of it. But it's not a bad match to certain aspects of the machine learning work that I like to do. I was raving about that memory bandwidth that it's got, which is it's just insane, the memory bandwidth this thing has. Like you can't buy computers that are in its class from a memory bandwidth standpoint. And that makes a bunch of problems that you struggle with in machine learning just go away. So I was super excited to get it.
Awesome, man. How much does that run for, like, your model?
How much?
That you got? Yeah, just curious.
I think I paid $6,000 for this 6,000.
One. So I wanted to thank you for just the past year of conversations, because I think you've helped me tremendously, because going into the specifics of the whole, you know, Tesla FSD approach, from the hardware to the neural nets to the training to the computer to the just even down to kind of when it makes mistakes, why it makes mistakes, you know, driving, all of that stuff has been tremendously helpful. And it's helped me understand first what Tesla's doing with FSD and how competent they really are. It's helped me to see the market potential, you know, that Tesla has. It also kind of has made me become more confident in Tesla's advantage or competitive advantage, because when I'm driving FSD and I see like when it makes a mistake, I'm now able to understand kind of, I kind of have a sense why it's making the mistake. And my conclusion is this FSD problem is so complicated. There's so many edge cases and it's just mindlessly, you know.
I remember talking to you the first time that we drove.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I didn't realize it was so complicated. Like, but you drive the car and you think about all the things that it's saying, you're like, God, there's
exactly
so much.
Yeah, and just appreciating that, I'm realizing, wow, it's like I don't think there is a second place in terms of any company trying to do what Tesla's doing in the scale of ambition.
Somebody else is just going to knock this out a couple weeks later after Tesla.
It's like, crazy. Yeah,
sure.
I mean,
like Boeing's right behind SpaceX. It's so easy. Once you know what the shape of the rocket is, you just make it, right?
Exactly. It's like the risk appetite, but also the competency that required to do it. It's just so many things. I'm like, there is no second place, you know, and the market is so huge. Even though it takes Tesla a little bit longer than maybe some people expect, to me, that's even more bullish in some ways, because it just shows how big and, you know, challenging this problem really is. And now, it's not going to be easy for anyone else, you know, to solve it.
To be fair, right? Waymo's got a lot of smart people. Cruise has got a lot of smart people. There are a lot of smart people working on this problem. And there are other people who are taking completely different approaches. And it is not entirely outside the realm of possibility that Tesla will have to rejigger that they'll hit a roadblock that will require a very significant step back to continue moving forward. I am not expecting that. But it's not outside the realm of possibility. And the fact that there are other people doing it completely, like there's at least 2 or 3 or 4 very, very different approaches that are being pursued by other companies that all these things are eventually going to work because the technology is just getting better. I've said before, and I stand by this, eventually it'll be a high school science project, right? The technology will get really, high school science, you can go on Kaggle and you can see high school kids doing stuff that was completely impossible data science 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, and self-driving is going to do that eventually in time. So people who believe that there will be other people doing it, and there will be other people doing it, but there's not going to be a fast follower like 12 months after Tesla does it. I mean, assuming Tesla gets there first, which I think is likely, but is not guaranteed.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of disagree where I think there will be obviously people doing self-driving on, you know, basic, but to the level of safety that the leader, let's say Tesla, yeah. has that requires the massive amounts of data.
And there's a network. Like, there's a big network effect.
Exactly. Too. Yeah.
And they're, like, you know, if Tesla gets there first, man, their network effect, because, you know, with millions of vehicles on the road, like you can't even, like, nobody, you know, if robotaxis need to be electric, right? Mm-hmm. Like, who's going to suddenly blow past the number of electric vehicles Tesla makes so that they're the one dominating the EV? Maybe there are companies in China. I don't follow it, you know, closely. Yeah. And an interesting possibility is the possibility that the architecture of robotaxis radically drifts away from what cars are. Right. I mean, people have speculated in the past that if robotaxis are super, super safe, you can really reduce the, you know, crash resistance requirement. Like, if they just don't crash, then the design requirements change in a significant way. And that might allow you to scale at low cost in ways that we can't really imagine with cars right now. Once again, I'm not expecting that to be something that happens in the short run, but 15, 20 years down the road, it could allow for real significant competition to show up.
Yeah. Awesome, man. So I want to, I think it's the least we could do to, I think myself and others, we should pitch in. We should pay for your laptop. I mean, that's the least we could do.
No.
That's the least we could do as James Download fans. As your fan
actually,
base.
Actually, listen.
Okay, think about it. Wouldn't it be kind of cool if, you know, whenever you use your laptop, you're like, hey, my fans bought this laptop for me, you know? Like, I think, wouldn't that be kind of cool?
I do appreciate the thought. It's a really nice thing to say. You know, I am super lucky. If you think that that's a good use, I would much rather people donate to your Afghan fund than make any kind of contribution to me. I am so fortunate with respect to these kinds of things. Like, it is a total waste of money to send me money. Like, it's a negative waste of money. You are just going to add to my problems in life because I have to find somebody else to give it to now.
Got it.
So yeah, do me a favor and find somebody who is really going to benefit from it and give it to them. And unfortunately the timing didn't, at the end of this year, was not good for me to be able to contribute to the thing that you're doing, but I was very impressed with what you've done on that. Like, you've been doing hero's work there, Dave. Good job.
Okay. Wow. That's awesome, man. So I was going to close the Afghan project tonight, and this is December 31st, but I was going to release this interview on January 1st in the morning, because I just released Ross Gerber, an interview with him today. So what I'll do is, I want to take you up on that offer I really think it would be great to give you a laptop, but for people pitch in $50 or $100, but if you're like adamantly against that's cool. Then let's direct that if people wanted to do that, wanted to show some appreciation to you, they could rather direct that to this Afghan food relief project that we're doing. So I'll leave it open, the Afghan food project, for another day. So it'll close January 1st at midnight Central Time. So people still have time to give to that project. But I'm excited for that project because I just talked with the nonprofits yesterday, and then they're blown away by the effort. And they're looking to have over 95% of the funds go directly to food and, you know, getting the food Afghanistan. And they have already the network on the ground. They're networked with like Rotary clubs and all these local organizations inside Afghanistan. And so they're already like contacting them, you know, getting the people ready.
So I looked through your playlist and I saw you discuss this with Emmett, a week ago or 2 weeks ago or something like that. But I actually haven't heard much of the details about it. Have you?
Yeah, there was a video I did. It's about 9 minutes long. It's called "The Biggest Crisis in the World?" And I kind of lay out the thing, but it's basically, there was already a drought going on for the past few years in Afghanistan, one of the worst in decades. COVID hit them bad because their economy kind of stalled. And then there, when the US pulled out 40%, the economy shrunk by 40% in 4 months. And then all these jobs dried up. And so you have this whole class of people, which is almost half of society, they're struggling for food, which is crazy. But the thing is, you can get food into the country. You could, you know, send food, you could buy food. They just don't have, you know, funds or resources. So I mean, we're not going to be able to tackle and solve the whole problem, obviously, ourselves. But we have a way where we could actually almost 95%, 95 cents out of every dollar should go to actually buying the food and getting it to the people, bypassing the Taliban, actually just getting it to the people in need. So yeah, I think it's a great project. But yeah, we'll keep it open. And anyone who's, you know, wanting to send something to James, you could, you know, direct that while it's still open tomorrow.
Yeah, please do. Yeah. It seems cool, like a very straightforward way to make a positive difference in the world right now.
Yeah. Awesome, man. All right, James, take care. I wish you a happy new year, a great 2022.
It's been fun. Yeah. Happy new definitely. Year, everybody.
Awesome, man. Okay. We'll talk later. Take care.
Take care.
All right. Bye.